The Reverend Dr. William Barber II, the president of the North Carolina NAACP, has written a book about the Moral Monday movement, which he led in North Carolina to counter the policies ushered in by the conservative extremists who took control of the state's government. It's called Forward Together, A Moral Message for the Nation. I asked Reverend Barber about what's next in the effort to organize against Tea Party Republicans in North Carolina and elsewhere in the South, after a key figure in the Tea Party takeover of the state, Tom Tillis, won his race for the Senate seat held by incumbent Democrat Kay Hagan.
Reverend Barber, I've been looking through your book, Forward Together, A Moral Message for the Nation, and saw how the book goes through the origins of the Moral Monday movement, up through the fall campaign where Tom Tillis kicks the Republican speaker of the State House of Representatives in North Carolina. That campaign for the Senate goes into full force, but obviously what we don't see in that book is how that race ended up. So I wanted to ask you first, if you were going to write another chapter to your book, given what happened on Election Day, what would that chapter say?
It worked. The movement worked. And I know that might sound paper, but that's the difference between movement time and moral times in an election. If some people look at it purely from the standpoint of what happened on Election Day, they would say, well, the movement didn't work. Well, we never judged our movement by one election, because we knew, number one, our movement is a state-based, state government-focused, deeply moral, deeply constitutional, anti-racist, anti-poverty, pro-justice fusion movement. So no matter what happened on November, we knew that Governor McCrory would still be the governor. We knew that the legislature would pretty much still be the same because of the race-based gerrymandering that we've not yet been able to turn over in court because of the stalling of our own state Supreme Court. What we would say is, number one, in order to beat this movement that's been operating more than since 2007 and added the Moral Monday component to the Forward Together movement in the last 2013, there are several things that Phyllis had to do. Number one, the extremists had to control every arm of government, and to do that, they had to rewrite the voting laws 2 years ago to set that in place. Number two, they had to pass the worst voter suppression bill because of the power of our movement transforming the consciousness of the people to suppress large amounts of the vote. Number three, they had to bring in hundreds of millions of dollars, or $100 million of money we know about, and more money, dark money. They had to call in every conservative extremist trick that has ever been played. And yet, with all of that, because the movement has shifted the consciousness of North Carolina so much, and the legislature was down to 19% in the polls, and the governor was down to 30-some percent in the polls, the best they could do with all of the voter suppression, all of the money, all of the trickery, was to eke out a 1.6% vote in a statewide U.S. Senate campaign. Tom Tillis got the lowest vote any senator running for Senate in North Carolina has ever received. And 51% of the people voted against him, which means if it would have been a two-person race, you had to have an independent in. And if the Democrats had run strong and not run from Obama and depressed their own base, would have seen a very different story. So it's kind of like the March on Washington. Our movement, as you know, the March on Washington didn't change everybody that was elected in 1964. What it did was it changed who the context in which they had to operate in. So guess what? In the last days, Isaiah, in order to win, Tom Tillis had to start talking about expanding Medicaid. Now, we believe it was just a political ploy, but he couldn't win because the pressure of the movement had so lifted high the need to do Medicaid expansion. In fact, now the governor is talking about Medicaid expansion. In order to win, Tom Tillis had to back off his attack on teachers and had to try to fool teachers that he'd actually given a pay raise. So we actually, in this election, see the power midterm. We had the highest turnout ever in a midterm in North Carolina, despite all of the voter suppression tactics, and that we know that thousands of people were either turned away, turned off, or turned out at the polls. So our movement is in no way tired. We are, in fact, emboldened. Because of our movement, and movement time is not always election time. You have to be in it for the long haul.
Right. One of the things that I found interesting about the exit polls, in fact, was that Hagan actually won among people under 45, younger voters.
Remember, in our movement, 30-40% of the people have been, you know, young people. This movement has spawned large amounts of young people. We did 150 some odd Ball Monday since last year. We did something in the neighborhood of 50 mass mall marches to the poll gatherings and organizing since August. We had 37 young people to go into 42 counties and register people for 4 weeks in the summer. They knocked on, called, or encountered 17,000 people and registered nearly 7,000 registered voters. So that's what I mean. The extremists knew there was a fire, an organizing fire in this state, and a commitment. And that's why they had to pull out all of these tricks. You know, give me an example. We know, we're getting reports now. The Brennan Center has already said that the amount of voter suppression can be directly correlated to the margin of victory in their preliminary report. We know that many, many people came to register on the same day thinking that North Carolina's laws would have been the same as they have been for the last three election cycles, and they were turned away. We know that precincts were removed, attempted removed from college campuses. We know in some counties there were 24 precinct changes by the new Republican leadership in the local election board. I myself had to go two different places to find my own precinct, and I'm a pretty astute voter. We also know, for instance, on election night, we went to one place with two precincts in one library. On one side, it was rural and affluent. No lines, big space, no problem. The other side was urban, black, white, and Latino. Small, hardly any space. Lines were 2.5 hours after the polls closed on election day. People were parking in the dark, parking along the road. People were getting tickets for parking as they were standing in line to register to vote. And in addition to that, some people were standing in line nearly an hour only to be told they were at the wrong precinct. And we know of several instances where at 7:29, people were turned away to go to another poll, and they didn't get there. They couldn't have gotten there. In previous years, they could have at least stayed in the line and voted for the senatorial candidate. So one of the things we have to look at is the total dynamic. And I think that's where some of the national media in their response have not really examined what happened here. Despite the fact that we think that Senator Hagan did not run the strongest campaign possible, they spent too much time, you know, as the extremists said, "I'm not Obama," saying, "Well, me neither." It didn't run hard enough on some of those issues. She still won in major cities because of the movement. But the movement, the book I wrote, Forward Together, is not so much about one election. And that's what I want to move away from, because that's the exact opposite of a moral movement, even though we are electorally conscious. A moral movement says part of the thing we have to do is that people vote because of deep pullings on the inside of them, when the narrative and the picture of the narrative captivates them. And we need, and also people vote when we can change language. Stop talking so much about Republican and Democrat, liberal versus conservative, to what's right versus what's wrong, what's constitutional, what's moral, what makes economic sense, as opposed to those things that are constitutionally inconsistent, morally indefensible, and economically insane. And if you look, finally, there at the great movements of our time, or in past time, the abolitionist movement had a deep moral foundation, and it won by being committed to the long haul. The first Reconstruction had a deep moral foundation. Look at the new constitutions that Southern states wrote from 1868 to 1872. They were deeply moral, based on our deepest religious values and our deepest constitutional values. early labor movement grew out of the social gospel movement that had a deep moral foundation. President Roosevelt's push for the New Deal and Social Security had a deep moral foundation. Thurgood Marshall, when he argued for the Supreme Court about separate equal, challenged it not just on legal grounds, but on deep moral grounds. So did the Civil Rights Movement, deep moral grounds. And we believe that in this 21st century, as we're in the embryonic stages of the Third Reconstruction, we need to return and recover that language that talks about budgets and health care and public education and LGBT rights and immigrant rights and labor rights and the criminal justice system as moral issues. And we believe, and we've shown here, that when you do that, it has great tenacity and calls people to a great level of commitment.
There's certainly a lot of evidence that voters are fed up with both political parties and are looking for something that is transcendent of the partisanship that they see in Washington right now. But I'm curious as to if you were sitting in a room with a bunch of Democratic Party operatives right now, as they are fumbling around trying to figure out what their, how do they fix what went wrong in this current election cycle, how would you tailor your message to speak to those operatives and to the candidates that they're going to be working for 2 years from now?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't probably sit in a room of Democrats. I want to sit in a room with both Democrat and Republican.
Okay.
I think that's the power of our movement. We have Democrats, Republicans, Independents. We had 1,006 people go to jail. 11 to 12% of them were Republicans and Independents. I've been able to organize in Mitchell County, North Carolina, Mitchell County. There's 99% white, 89% Republican. We have Republicans and Democrats who formed a new branch up there and are pushing hard. They were part of the Moral Monday Coalition. We've also been able to organize in counties that were heavily Democrat. I think it's not just about this election cycle. It's about the systemic way in which over the years we have, particularly progressives, have chosen, and I think one writer talked about this some years ago. Charles Koch said in 1974, I think it was, that they were going to not invest in messiah candidates, but invest in movement building. And they were going to put their movement in think tanks and organizing on the ground to build a movement from which candidates would come. But they were not just going to invest all their money and infrastructure into messiah candidates, and then once the candidate either lost or won or was no longer in office, all of that infrastructure was gone. Well, the reality is the Koch brothers in some way stole what Dr. King told us, and that's what progressives have got to understand. We've walked away sometimes from our own history. Dr. King said in a march on Washington, he said, go back. He never told us to come back to D.C. In fact, in some ways, that's where we're missing it. We're focusing too much on D.C., and we forget that D.C. is determined by state capitals, because state capitals determine redistricting laws that determine who gets into the United States Congress. State capitals determine voting laws. State capitals determine how, for instance, the Affordable Care Act is implemented, or Medicaid is implemented, or long-term unemployment is implemented, or earned income tax credit is implemented, or public education is implemented. So in some ways, we need to understand the first reconstruction, the transformation of America, came from the ground up, from the states up. That's why conservatives and extremists have always argued for states' rights, because they know the power of the state. In the 60s, movement didn't start in D.C. down. It started from Montgomery up, from Birmingham up, from Greensboro up. So in real sense, we need state-based movement with indigenous leadership that's not trying to push from D.C. down, but we're trying to bubble up from the ground, if you will. And in that context, Isaiah, as I said, Dr. King said, that's not so much interested in being a political party, but being a moral force that brings people together to understand their commonality, to understand their connectedness, a movement that destroys the myth of extremism. And that myth is we can hurt black people without hurting everybody. We can hurt poor people without hurting everybody. We can hurt the LGBT community or immigrants without hurting everybody. And when we begin to show the intersectionality of these issues and begin to reclaim the moral power, for instance, when we can begin to say to folks, as I said a few in the mountains when I went to Mitchell County, and Republicans up there join with us by saying we're not Tea Parties, we're Eisenhower, Teddy Roosevelt Republicans. That Republican chair resigned up there. But I was able to show them, listen, the extremist attempt to suggest that something like Medicaid expansion is going to, i.e., help them that don't deserve it, i.e., white Southern strategy terminology is black people. But in reality, there are 2,000 or 3,000 people in your county in this these mountains that are growing, that are being denied health care, and some of them will die because of a decision to fight Medicaid expansion simply because you don't like a president, and that is immoral. I didn't say it was Republican. I said it's immoral, and they got it, and they joined with us. And so we've got to have a movement committed to the long term. And progressives have got to decide. They're not going to be so bomb shocked or shell shocked by the way in which the extremist right wing has used the language of morality and has limited the discussion to abortion, homosexuality, and prayer in the school. Instead, a progressive got to understand why would extremists spend so much time trying to hijack a moral discussion and a moral movement? Because they know the power of it. They know the power of it. If you begin to get people to talk about poverty and minimum wage increase and labor rights from a moral perspective, it is a very different conversation, and it will open up a very different kind of action. If we had just said we're going to the legislature to challenge Republicans, we wouldn't have had 1,006 people, more people than ever in the history of this country, to get arrested at a state legislature. You wouldn't have had 80 to 100,000 people show up because they would say it's just another political thing. But when people understand fighting for health care, fighting for fair wages, fighting for voter rights is a matter of the soul of the state and our own personal soul, if you will, because it gives us an opportunity to be engaged in something that literally is about changing the flow of history, people will come into that in massive ways.
Thank you for that. The thing that I see that running up against is as we have a country where there is such a wide gap between the 99%, if you will, and people at the very top. As people feel as if they have fallen behind, as they feel, as they said in exit polls, that their children are not going to do as well as they are doing. You know, one of the things that, you know, one of the possible ways you could react to that, and I think a lot of people have reacted this way, is that they become more inward, they become more insular, and frankly less generous about the rest of the society around them.
Right, because if you allow Fox News to be the only ones talking about all issues and limited them, like I saw a report last night where they were talking about, you know, somebody fighting to keep the word under God in the pledges of allegiance, and they were missing the whole point about justice for all. So I agree with you. People do, and that's what moral arguments do. First of all, a moral framing allows you to touch the pain. You can't deny the pain. It's not some false kind of optimism. You actually touch the pain. You bring people together, even in their tears, but then the tears, as Brueggemann says, walk through it, unites us. But also the moral framing gives us a different kind of hope, the kind of hope, you know, the slaves had when they said, you know, in slavery, up above my head. It calls people to a recovery of their humanity. That's why we've had even atheists and agnostics join this movement. Because whether they come at it from a religious perspective or a constitutional perspective, it has tremendous power. And what I'm saying to you is, it's not something that's going to saying, "Well, Father, who told you quit?" No, we know now we can win. We just got to dig in and do like our foreparents did, you know. And that's one thing the NAACP has understood. We started in 1909. We knew it was going to be a long track to overturn Plessy, but we stayed in there. We stayed in there. It took abolitionists a while, but they hung in there. The civil rights movement took a while. So this is not some quickie, but it is the only way, I believe, that either we're going to claim the deep moral foundations of our Constitution and revive both the heart and soul of people, or we're not. So, for instance, let me give you a good take. In our Constitution, it says all political power comes from the people, and it should be solely used for the good of the whole. We got our lawyers getting ready to do lawsuits based on that principle. We got movement. We're in the legislative halls. We're organizing and building people's assemblies around the state. I just got off this morning with folk in Georgia. They're talking about continuing to move. People will become engaged in a different way when they see this as when they have a deeply moral movement. I had a lady one day come in. You talk about people that don't have. I was in the grocery store one day, and she came up to me and said, "Reverend Barber, how are you?" She said, "I can't get up there to Raleigh, but I want you to take this." And it was 82 cents. And I said, "Ma'am, I can't." But she says, "No, take this 82 cents and buy some gas or something, because you don't know how this movement is inspiring the rest of us to stand up." Now, if you judge it by one election, then that's not a good judgment. That's what people want us to do who are into microwave movements. It's just like in Christianity. If you judge Christianity by Friday, you're going to miss Sunday resurrection. If you judge the Old Testament by the Red Sea, you're going to miss the party. So we are not bound by any one election. When the people, for instance, marched across the Edmunds Pettus Bridge in 65, they did not change one person in the Congress, not one. They didn't change anybody in the Congress. But they changed the content. Lyndon Baines Johnson didn't intend to sign off on the Voting Rights Act, but the contour and the consciousness of the South and of the country was changed by people deeply committed. And as Dr. King often said, I'm gonna hold you true to what you said on paper. In other words, you put your hand on the Bible and swear to uphold the Constitution, I'm going to make sure you know what's in both. And so on the one hand, Dr. King would be quoting the Bible that Justice wrote down like waters. On the other hand, he would be quoting the 15th Amendment of the Constitution. We don't hear even this kind of conversation at many of our organizing summits. We don't hear it a lot of time on our political pundits. But if you go back, remember the 64 speech that Kennedy did the night Nate Evers was killed. He talked about it being a moral issue, the Civil Rights Act. Lyndon Baines Johnson talked about the Voting Rights being a moral issue. We have to recover that language, because it produces, if you will, Isaiah, what we call in theology, subversive hope, the kind of recovery of the imagination of what can be. And until people's imagination is recovered, and you're right, some of them have just turned out, but they're not totally turned off. Until people's imagination can be recovered, implementation is not even possible. Let me give you one final anecdotal story. So we're doing Ball Monday, and I get a call. And one Monday we're out, and this 92-year-old lady shows up, Rosa Nelly, on a walker. She says, "Rep Bob, I'm coming out of retirement." She said, "I got frustrated with this stuff, but now they're attacking voting rights." She said, "I registered 5,000 people to vote in my lifetime. I fought the Klan." She said, "I used to be violent. I didn't believe in nonviolence until I met Dr. King. I had to read the preamble to the Constitution to somebody that couldn't even read themselves to register to vote. I'm going today in this legislature." I said, "Madam, Ms. Rosenberg, you don't have to do that. You're an elder." She said, "Shut up." She said, "Hush. I know what I'm doing. I've got to do this. And I've got to do it at 92 so that other people will do it." So she gets in the line on a walk. When she does that, a 92-year-old white woman comes up and stands beside her and says, "I'm going in too." And they led over 100 people that day and got arrested in the Jonah cell. Now, both of those ladies came from very different worlds. One 92 in white, one 92 in black, very different worlds. But they came on a ball Monday, captivated by the energy and the ethics of the movement. And now, Rosemary Eaton is our lead plaintiff on the voting rights case we had, which is the first case after Shell. And already we've gotten some signals from the Fourth Circuit that our case is very powerful, and we're going to at least be able to turn back. If we keep this movement going long enough and strong enough, we don't even know the possibilities of transformation that can happen. But we saw just a glimpse of it, even in this election, though we don't measure the movement by election, because with all the trickery, all the suppression, the best they could do at the Senate level was a 1.6% win, 30 votes per precinct, and the lowest vote for a U.S. Senate candidate ever in the history of North Carolina to win, and 51% of the people voting against. That is not a sign of us losing. That is a sign of a growing breaking through of the old Southern strategy that's happening right here in North Carolina that I believe can happen across the South.
Well, let me ask you one final question. How do you then spread this across the country? And what do you need in order for that to happen?
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me thank Isaiah Poof, you for things like coming to networks, because that helps in getting this message into the various gatherings where people are organized so that people can actually hear it and not, you know, misinterpret it or just think, oh, this is just a preacher and a bunch of preachers that, you know, just marching. It's far deeper than that. In fact, in the book, I asked people to read it because why we took people through several Mall Mondays was to show them what happened and then the language, the oratory, if you will, that occurred that day, and how it was quasi-social, moral, political speech, and how important that is. And then the aftermath. The book also takes you through the things that led up to, like building relationships with the LGBT community and the labor community and doing the hard spade work of organizing over 6 years to even be in position to do this Mall Monday piece 7 years post that. We also take you through in the back the steps, the 12 foundational steps to building a Mall movement that includes everything from how you name the movement to civil disobedience to the legal structure that you need, not just to get people out of jail, but actually how you can take the issues stirred up by the movement into court and win, all the way down to how you register and educate people, the voters, to vote. That is all in the book, and I encourage people to read it. But interestingly enough, already you have Mall Monday, Georgia, Mall Monday, Indiana. You've got a form of Mall Monday breaking out in Florida. I just talked to them the other day, Alabama. And we're going to be talking this coming Tuesday from about 12 states about how we continue to make this connection between the civil rights community, NAACP, and other bodies to build this moral movement. And each state will be unique. That is the other thing. There will not be one leader. As you notice, it said a moral message to the nation, not the moral leader of the nation, because we believe in the time that we have what we call the new interposition and nullification. These southern legislatures and governors are engaging in a kind of a 21st century form of interposition and nullification, that we need independent, indigenously led state movement. So when I go to a state and they say we're interested in doing a Mall Monday, NAACP invites me or someone else says it, I tell them, my friend, I'm not here to lead it. I do a 2-day training on the components, the mechanisms, the spade work, the hard work, and then I say to them very clearly, you want to know how the March on Washington worked? It was because in 200 cities, people were engaged. People were engaged in civil disobedience because in every place, Dr. King didn't have to go to be the leader. Birmingham had Fred Shuttleworth. You know, yeah. Montgomery had had certain people. St. Augustine in Florida had people. You know, people were everywhere. They were building up the sit-in movements. You had movements happening in Greensboro, but also out in Kansas and other places. I can go on and name all of them.
Yeah.
And I can remind them that's the critical point, Isaiah, is that we must have an indigenously led, homegrown led moral movement. And I believe that if this small message I'm giving can help to sow the seed, that the seeds can grow into a mighty movement.
Well, I really appreciate all the work that you've done as the person who's been sort of the matchstick to get this fire going. So we thank you for that and for your book.
Well, thank you, and thank you for your readers for hopefully purchasing. Part of the proceeds goes to help support the movement. February 14th, we're having a big mass mobilization march in North Carolina to fight for minimum wage increase and Medicaid expansion and protecting voter rights. We invite people to come. And you may hear very soon, Isaiah, a simultaneous effort that's going to happen in a number of states next year. We are a long ways from over. We intend to keep the pressure on. One of the scriptures we use in the movement says, we are not of those who shrink back unto destruction, but we are those who persevere to the salvation of the soul. That's one of the scriptures. And one of the quotes is, Frederick Douglass, power never concedes nothing. It never has. It never will. Those who want power without struggle are like those who want the ocean without the roar of its waves, who want the stars without the darkness of the night. It will always require struggle, maybe a moral one, maybe a physical one, but we know that there will always require struggle to make America a better place, and we're committed to that struggle.
Well, thank you very much.
God bless you, my friend. Take care.
You too. Take care.